Hi, this is Tavi Greiner, Astronomy.fm's Vice President of Communications. If you enjoy our programming, please let us know with a donation to astronomy.fm/donate. We really do rely on your support, and it's true, every little bit counts.
AFM.
Program complete. Enter when ready.
The curtain of night is drawn back. The telescopes are trained. The domes are open. The audience is set. Now, step into the event horizon.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Event Horizon here on Astronomy.fm Radio. It is another Friday evening. This one happens to be June the 15th, 2018, 9 o'clock in the evening for those of us here in the eastern portion of North America. The Universal Time would put it at 1 o'clock in the morning, Saturday morning, June the 16th, 2018. So that means we are live. My name is Marty Coons with my co-host.
Good evening, everybody. It's me, Nick Avett, 2 Echo Zero, Lima, Uniform, November.
And, of course, we have our Astronomy.fm radio chat room open for everybody to come on over and join us. Want to find it, go to the homepage where it says radio chat. Click on that. Just do something simple like type in a name. Doesn't have to be your real name, but be polite. Hit the word login. Forget the password part. And you'll start. Part of our radio show, basically. You can ask us questions. We're going to, if you have astronomy pictures, you can post them in there. We can look at them. Anybody else can look at them, and it's in the chat room, too. So come on over and join us. We got you and me there so far, Nick. We got Glenn, Black Project, Evil Spock, Starstorm, and Redshirt 3 in our chat room right now.
Hey, everybody. And, nice to see you.
Go ahead. And if we talk about, you know, a specific article that we reference, we'll put a link to that article so you can read it a little bit later. Especially it helps if you're in one of the repeat programs, because we repeat this program every 4 hours. So it's kind of nice to look at the article while you're listening to us talk on the repeat if you want to get what we're talking about. So.
The really nice thing is both the Event Horizon and Space Pirates, we do post the show notes both on the astronomy.fm website and on Facebook.
Yep.
Now, we don't have a Facebook page for the Event Horizon. Maybe we should, Marty.
Oh, maybe.
But the thing is, I post everything to the astronomy.fm page.
Okay.
Including a lot of other stuff that comes across my path, whether it's from the ESO or from LPOD or whatever. So there's plenty of posts going on there. Now, being June, good evening, Starstorm. Bonjour. Let's have a quick look at we didn't use the constellations link from last week's show. So let's have a look at the five June constellations. So we have, I'll put the link into chat.
Okie dokie.
Okay.
Which I was going to say, you know, I've got an astronomy.fm Facebook page, because I grabbed that name really quick when Facebook started coming in. So maybe I can kind of convert that to a Event Horizon.
That might be a good idea, actually, because, yeah, as I say, Dale very nicely gathers the links for mm-hmm. Space Pirates. He emails them to me. I put them onto the website, the AFM website via WordPress,
mm-hmm.
and of course I post that as well. Now, I know that there was problems with the links midweek. However, the good thing, as I can tell you, is that when I posted everything to the AFM website, mm-hmm. everything worked.
Nice.
So,
I think technology it's Facebook, for you.
It's a Facebook thing. It garbles links. The other thing is I'm going to let everybody know here and now. I want people saying, you never told us, Nick. In October, I will be missing for a couple of weeks because I'm heading back to the UK for a fortnight, 2 weeks, and I'm going to have a wee break.
And you're not going to get up at 2 in the morning to do the show?
No, not. I might. It really depends, but because, as I say, I'm going to be fairly busy with sorting stuff out in the UK, so
Depends if you're awake or not.
Depends if I'm awake and depends if I am actually sober. Because I already have drinks set up with some of my fellow Sky Guides, with Mary and Mark McIntyre and Neil Norman. We're all getting together, the Comic Watch team, for
Pubs don't stay up. The pubs don't stay open late there, do they?
Yes, they do, actually.
Well, I mean, not past 2, though, do they?
Really depends.
The only ones I know of,
yes.
Okay, the only ones I know in the U.S., I think, is like New York State stays open till about 4 in the morning. And Michigan State, they stay open till 2. And where was I was in Vermont, I think, and they only stay open till 1 o'clock.
That's possible.
And there's like – There are some people from New York saying, what do you mean you're closing? It's only 1 o'clock. Like, they're used to 4 o'clock in the morning closing.
Well, I'd say, don't worry, Glenn. It's not for a while yet. Mm-hmm. But I really need to go home to see family and sort some stuff out.
Mm-hmm.
Are the barrels still at Mum's house? Yes, I still have homebrew barrels to fill up with homemade wine and beer.
And empty out?
They're actually empty at the minute.
And okay.
At some point, they will actually be full again.
There you go.
And drinking the good old homebrew.
Mm-hmm. Wine,
anyway, we get the wine, the cider, the beer, the IPA. Can't beat a good bit of, a good drop of homebrew IPA. We're getting away from the subject. June constellations. So we have five we have five constellations this month. Bootes the herdsman, Circassinus the drawing compass, Libra the scales, Lupus the wolf, and of course Ursa Minor, the little bear, or if I suppose you call it over here, the little dipper.
The asterism is the little dipper, but it is the little bear, the official constellation.
Yeah, IPA, yum, yum, yum. I can't wait. I buy it once a month. I buy about 5 bottles of it because when I'm having a curry, it will be like, I've got to have IPA. I've got to have India Pale Ale with a curry.
Okay. Are there some highlights in these constellations?
Well, okay, highlights. Let's start off with Bootes.
Okay. When you come around here, I've got one for Lupus, by the way.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So the constellation Bootes the Herdsman is visible in the Northern Hemisphere from spring through summer. It's visible from between 90 degrees and minus 50 degrees. It covers about 907 square degrees. This is the 13th largest constellation in the night sky. It is bordered by Virgo to the south, Coma Berenices and Coma Venusae to the west, Ursa Major to the northwest, Draco to the northeast, and Hercules Corona Borealis and Serpens Caput to the east. Is one of the original 48 constellations listed by the Greek astronomer Ptolemy in the 2nd century. Its name comes from the Greek word that means ox driver, plowman, or herdsman. It's typically depicted as a herdsman, along with his faithful hounds, Canis Venusae. He follows the two bears, Ursa Major and Ursa Minor, around the pole. It's an ancient constellation. It's even been known since the time of the Babylonians. They depicted it as their god Ernil, who was the leader of the Babylonian pantheon and the patron of farmers. The Greeks actually once called this constellation Arctophylax, which means the protector of the bear. The Romans called it Veneta Ursae, the bear hunter. And the name Bootes first appeared in the Odyssey written by the Greek author Homer almost 3,000 years ago. Yeah, Richard, you can't beat a good curry. And homemade curry is the business, mate. And, of course, the interesting thing is over here – oh, God, I'm getting sidetracked again. Over here, when my first time I went to an Indian restaurant over here, I sat down. The waiter showed me to my seat. I sat down. I didn't really say much at first. And he comes over with the menu, and it's like, what would you like to order, sir? And I looked and says, well – I'll start off with a picture of Kingfisher, which is beer. Then I'll have a lamb rogue and Josh, medium to spicy, and onion bhajis, naan bread, and do you have Bombay aloo, which is a spicy potato dish? So, and his eyes lit up. He says, "Ah, sir is British." I go, Yeah, and he says, very well, I will tell Chef to make your Rogue on Josh for you properly. And the guy behind me, in a very, very, what do you mean, make it properly for you? You mean it's not proper curry? He goes, I am very sorry, sir, but the American palate cannot eat one of the Indian national dishes the way the British do, because they became accustomed to it during their stay in India for the 200 years they were there as our rulers. Mm. So I caught the waiter's eye, pointed to the menu, pointed, I think, this guy wants a hot curry, I'll make sure he has a hot curry, and pointed to a vindaloo.
Where's chicken vindaloo? How's that associated with something semi-astronomy space-wise?
Sorry, I got sidetracked by the comments in the chat room. Curry time. Aqua for you wants an FTL spaceship for dinner. I would say you better go see Seth MacFarlane.
Seth MacFarlane? Nope, not Seth MacFarlane.
Well, the Orville is faster than light.
Chicken. Oh yeah, chicken vindaloo. What was that? Always mentioned.
Vindaloo. Actually, okay. Astronomical reference. Chicken vindaloo leaves you at the speed of light.
No. Okay. More space than astronomy. Two million years from Earth is another clue.
Yeah. Put it this way.
What was that from?
2 million years from Earth?
Yeah. Chicken vindaloo.
Oh, Red Dwarf, of course.
Yes.
but seriously, the only bad downside to having a curry in space, you can never escape the smell in a spacesuit. And I'm not talking about the curry smell.
Well, it's a spacesuit, it's your own curry, so it's different from a spaceship.
But,
okay. So yeah, that's Boaties. Boaties, which you can find by the handle of the Big Dipper, Arcs to Arcturus. And that's at the bottom of Boaties, the southern portion. Yeah. And right nearby, there's a double star, too. That's really close, a close pair of doubles. I can't remember what it is, though.
Okay, so you've got Izar, which means the Veil, which is a binary star system. You have Arcturus, which is called the Guardian of the Bear. It's an orange giant star, magnitude 0.04. You have Merfid, which is the solitary one, which is a yellow-white sub-dwarf star. Sejanus, origin unknown. That's a blue giant, and that's a magnitude 3.3. Hey, Optronics, great to see you. You have Nekar, which is the cattle driver, which is a yellow-white star. Sigma Boötes is a yellow-white dwarf. Rho Boötes, which is an orange giant. Zeta Boötes, which is another binary system. You have Acellus Primus, the first donkey colt, which is an orange giant star. Lambda Boötes, a white dwarf. Not a red dwarf, a white dwarf.
There you go.
Bold outside. Sorry. Okay. You have...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Lurapus, the shepherd star, which is actually a triple star system. Tau Boötes, which is another binary. Nadalat, which means little ones, is an orange giant. Acellinus Tertius, which means the third donkey cock, which is a blue-white subgiant. Xi Boötes, which is another binary. Have you noticed something? There's an awful lot of multiple star systems in this constellation.
Mm-hmm.
Acellus Secundus, which is the second donkey cock, which is another subgiant blue-white, blue star. And, of course, Mergra, the chained woman, which is a blue-white sub-dwarf star. So, really, when you think about it, it's quite an interesting system. And, of course, there's Boötes 1, the Boötes dwarf galaxy, which is nearby as well. So, definitely something to do there, look for in Boötes. If not anything, spending some time splitting doubles and triple star systems.
One little note, I don't know if it's actually in Boötes or a little bit over in Canis something or other, one of the dogs, Canis Venatici. M3, nice globular cluster.
Yeah.
just west of Bootes.
Okay, so in the drawing compass, looking at this, it's a dim constellation. The only only has one star brighter than magnitude 4, and it's Alpha Circini, with a visual magnitude of about 3.18. And guess what? It's a binary star system, and it's only 53 light years from Earth. The second star, of course, is Beta Circini, with a magnitude of 4.7, and it's about 97 light years from us, and it's a blue-white subgiant. The third brightest star is Gamma Circini, with a magnitude of only about 4.48. It's a binary star system that's about 509 light years away. So, that's the highlights of that
What's the name of that constellation?
Circinius, the drawing compass.
Circinius?
Circinius, yes.
All right, don't remember that. I know it's there.
It's about ascension 15, declination minus 60.
Okay.
And it crosses the meridian at 9 p.m. on June the 20th.
Okay, dope.
Okay, so what else do we have to look forward to? Of course, Libra or Libra, take your pick. Mm-hmm. It's called the Scales. It's visible between 65 degrees and minus 90. Medium-sized constellation is about 538 square degrees. It's 29th in size amongst the 88 constellations in the night sky. Now, it has some interesting stars. And it does have one multiple star system. That's Zubin Elijek. We did this one last week.
Zubin El-Janubi or Zubin El-Shamali?
Zanubi, the Southern Scorpion Claw.
Southern one, okay.
It's a visual magnitude of a 2.75. It's got some nice red giants. It's got an orange giant star, a blue-white dwarf. Well, it's got three orange giants, at least. And one, two, three blue-white dwarf star. So, again, it's something you can really... Yeah. Okay, and it's Sirius is blue. Jupiter's more like a cream and slightly yellow color. Doesn't flicker as much. Yep, that's from the chat room.
Okay.
So, Abtronix has Jupiter right up in the middle of the sky. Or is it Sirius, he is saying? Sirius is blue, appears blue. So if he's not flickering as much, he's probably going to be Jupiter, which is a cream or slightly yellow car. And with good binoculars, which I can attest to, you can actually see the four Galilean moons.
Mm-hmm.
Very small dots, but well worth it.
Yes.
Libra has no messy objects, but it does have a few deep sky objects. It includes a barred spiral galaxy known as NCG 5792, a lenticular galaxy NGC 5890, and a glob NGC 5897.
Mm-hmm.
They are extremely dim, and they can only be seen with large telescopes.
5897 is not so bad. It's only about 8.5 magnitude, so that's kind of a nice globular.
It's not bad for a glob.
Like yeah.
This. So, we're off to, well, you want to
I like globs.
You take over for Lupus the Wolf?
No, I got just one item in Lupus, so go ahead.
Okay.
Give the rundown, and so, I'll add something to it.
So, Lupus the Wolf, it takes up about 334 square degrees of the sky, visible between latitudes 35 and minus 90. It's located in the southern hemisphere. It's best seen in the northern hemisphere in June, and it's completely visible at latitudes between 35 degrees north and minus 90 degrees. It's a mid-sized constellation. It ranks 46 in size amongst the 88 constellations, and it's bordered by the constellations Hydra, Scorpius, Norma, Circinius, Libra and Centaurus. It's sometimes confused with the constellation Lepus the Rabbit.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's one of the 48 constellations first identified by Ptolemy in the 2nd century. It means the wolf in Latin. Even though it's one of the older constellations, it's not associated with any mythology. The stars that make up this constellation were originally part of the constellation Centaurus, and they represent an animal that has been killed by the centaur. It was separated by Centaurus by the Greek astronomer Hipparchus in the 3rd century BC, and no animal was associated with it. The ancient Greeks knew it as Therum, a wild animal. The Romans called it Bestia, a beast, and a later translation of Ptolemy's wolf work finally identified it as a wolf. What do we have there? Well, we've got quite a few blue-white giant stars. MEN, which is the Southern Gate, is a magnitude 2.30. Kakuan Imperial Guards is another blue-white at 2.68. Now, there is at least one multiple star system. Well, actually, there's three. The first one is Epsilon Lupi, or Lupi, take your pick. That's at magnitude 3.41. The next one, of course, is Pi Lupi at 3.89 and Chi Lupi at 3.96. So the nice thing about some of these constellations is that there is some stuff there, too, and you can have fun splitting out binary and triple star systems. So it is definitely well worth going there. It has no Messier objects, but it does have some notable deep skies. NGC 5986 is a glob that contains thousands of individual stars. That's about 33,900 light years from Earth. The Retina Nebula is a planetary nebula with a rainbow of colors.
It's only about seventh magnitude, so a fairly nice globular again.
Okay, so you've got the Retina Nebula. It's a donut-shaped nebula seen from the side. And, of course, NGC 5882 is another planetary nebula with delicate wisps of pink and blue gas. These objects are considered extremely dim by the author of this particular website, and says can only be seen with large telescopes. Well, define a large telescope. I would certainly say 10 inches onwards, you've probably got a very good chance of certainly seeing the planetaries. However,
that globular, too, would be pretty easy.
And the glob, yeah. But I say, having said that, it's going to be very, very faint and dim to the naked eye.
Mm-hmm.
If you really want to bring out any detail and see any color, you're going to need to use either a DSLR or a decent CCD and stack. So that leaves us just the one left.
Wait a minute. Let me get the one thing on Lupus. An alert notice from the American Association of Variable Star Observers reports a nova in Lupus discovered on June the 5th, so just like 10 days ago, so still there. So look up that alert notice number 637 and it's only a ninth magnitude nova. And they want more images. They want some images of it, whether it's DSLR or CCDs or whatever you've got, filtered, unfiltered. They're still looking for more images of this object. So ninth magnitude nova, especially good for southern hemisphere observers. And if it's a high enough for northern hemisphere, it's borderline declination -47. So maybe a little bit better for southern hemisphere observers, because this one's south of what we just talked about, the scales, Libra the scales.
Now, Optronics asked a question: how can it be orange? Is it from Florida? No. As it was pointed out in the chat room, orange stars are actually cooler than our sun. K-type main sequence dwarf star spectral type K. So, as an archer for you says, I just had a bowl of K-type stars with my Wheaties. Okay, fine. I'll take that under advisement. Don't know if that's safe to you can go back to.
No. If you're going to have breakfast, you got to have special K.
That's what he's referring to. I prefer Frosties, personally, if I'm going to have cereal.
Well,
but if I'm going to really have a really good breakfast, it's going to be a nice piece of back bacon on a nice piece of fresh artisan bread with a little bit of HP sauce.
Yeah, but we're talking orange juice with special K cereal, so gotta be more.
But you still got to have milk with the actual cereal.
Well, it's real close to the Milky Way.
It won't ruin your appetite either.
That's right.
Oh, the old adverts. I remember Milky Way bars being advertised as the chocolate you can have without ruining your appetites.
I don't remember if I like.
Thank you, Black Projects, for putting that link into chat about K's type stars. Appreciate it.
Alrighty, yep. Go to the chat room. Sign in, everybody.
Go to the chat room. Yep, sign in. Tell us who you are.
It's fun if you want to. Fake. At least tell us where you're listening in from. You don't have to commit to anything. No details.
And at this point in the show, I'm just going to say hola to my friends in South America, to my hello to my friends in the Philippines, Thailand, and I know that occasionally we get listeners from Korea, South Korea, and a few people, I've heard of a couple of people who've actually listened in from mainland China.
I want to say sorry to Black Project. You wanted a link to that Nova. Let me put that. Let me go back to that page, and I'll put it in. I'll put it in our chat room there. So hang on a second here. All right, there we go. Coming into the chat room, and there you go.
Okay, so we've got another link in the chat room.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Ursa Minor. It is one of the 48 constellations identified by Ptolemy again in the 2nd century. It means the lesser bear in Latin, and it's an ancient constellation with roots in many cultures. The ancient Babylonians, it was known as the Wagon of Heaven. In Greek mythology, this was associated with two different myths, actually. One, it represents Ida and her sister Adrasia, the nymphs who took care of Zeus on the island of Crete when he was small. Zeus rewarded them by placing them in the heavens. In another, it represents Arcas, who was the son of Zeus, and the nymph Callisto. Arcas and his mother were transformed into bears and placed in the night sky. Okay, so what do we have? Hey, guess what? Polaris, the pole star. And it's a multiple star system, aren't we? This is the great thing. We have seem to have an awful lot of multiple star systems. So if you're really into splitting binaries and triple star systems, you're going to have a lot of fun. In fact, you're going to like this constellation even more. It has a triple star system.
Since it's the tail of the bear, I guess you could call it splitting hairs.
I suppose.
Or unless that would be back to Lepus. Well, never mind.
No, Lepus is a rabbit.
Yeah, well, rabbit or hare?
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
Hare today, gone tomorrow.
Have you seen the companion to Polaris, by the way?
I haven't actually split the multiple system.
Ah. Yeah, try that sometime.
Yeah, when I get my dob, maybe.
Hmm.
Because that's going to be at F3.3 at 20 inches.
Almost any scope will pretty much split it. It's not that bad. It's not that hard.
But it's not what I tend to look at or image, unfortunately. But never mind. Anyway, going back to, we have a triple star system, Epsilon Ursa Minoris, at magnitude 4.21. We have a white dwarf star. Sorry, no red dwarfs yet. I'm sure that Holly is happy about that. And I'm sure.
Yeah.
Rimmer?
Rimmer, the hologram. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because Rimmer was also the hologram after Holly.
Mm-hmm. Holly was like the ship's AI, I think it was.
Yes, but Holly was also the hologram for a while.
Was it? Okay.
Yeah, and then Rimmer supplanted her.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we've got Yukdin, the star, which is a blue-white subgiant. Seems to be an awful lot of these blue-white subgiants about.
Mm.
And, of course, Anwar al-Farkadain, the brighter calf, which is a yellow-white dwarf star at 4.95 magnitude. Remember, if it's in positive numbers, it's slightly dimmer. If it's in negatives, bright.
Mm-hmm.
Very bright. Anyway, so it only has not quite naked eye, but you can actually see most of the stars naked eye, but you just can't split them. So anyway. Okay, so what does Ursa Minor have? No Messiers, but it has a few interesting deep sky objects. A barreled spiral galaxy known as NGC 6217, a dwarf spectral galaxy called Ursa Minor Dwarf, and an active supergiant elliptical radio galaxy known as NGC 6251. Again, the author of the website says that they're very dim and can only be seen with large telescopes. I would beg to differ. I would suspect at least an 8-inch onwards would definitely allow you to see some of these dimmer objects.
Yeah.
Again, cameras, either DSLR or CCD, you will definitely be able to resolve it.
6217 is reported at 11th magnitude, so dark skies, an 8-inch would definitely would do it. And let's see, 5832, about 12th magnitude, on the edge for a galaxy for an 8-inch, so you might want to get up to a 10-inch on that one.
But as I say, there's lots of things you can do in the summer. Most people are put off because of the length of daylight, and for the next 4 days, as I was reminded by Black Projects, the days and nights are going to be of equal length. We're coming up to midsummer. It's also nucleescent cloud season, which kind of makes up
noctiluminescent.
That's also another way to say it.
Yeah. Nighttime and light,
and it is 21:30 hours EDT. So, Marty, what should you be doing?
A little station identification. You are listening to the Event Horizon program here on Astronomy.fm Radio. It is halfway through our program, so that means we still have another half hour of programming for you to listen to. And then we will repeat this program with other programs every 4 hours for the next 24 hours. So if you've missed the first half, you can always catch up on one of the repeats. And don't forget, we got more programs to listen to too. So it's June the 15th, about 9:30 in the evening, 2018, for those of us here in the eastern portion of North America, and that's daylight savings time. It's actually universal time at 1:30 in the morning, Saturday morning, June the 16th, again, 2018. And don't forget, reminder to come on over to our astronomy.fm chat room if you like to. If you have any questions for us, we try to answer them for you the best we can live on air. Feel free to type in a question. You can find our chat room at the homepage. Look near the top there where it says radio chat. Click on that. Type in a name. Forget the password. Hit log in, and you'll be in our chat room. And ask us a question or just say hi. Or people in the chat room can also ask questions too or post links to pictures they've taken, stuff like that. It's always fun.
Optron says that's an unbelievable scope, F3.3. He thought that Aquas was fast. A lot of scopes seem to be heading faster and faster. Now, it's going to be an interesting experiment as to whether I need a flattener or a focal reducer.
Depending on how they built the scope and how accurate.
This is going to be a daub.
Well, the shorter the F ratio, the harder it is to make a parabola. And it's also very difficult, yeah, to definitely get a flat field of view. Usually it's pretty curved. So a coma corrector is another thing that's called. So what that means is that dead center, everything should be, you know, perfectly, like a star would be perfectly focused and round and stuff like that. When you get off to the sides too far away, though, the stars start getting elongated, pointing towards the middle, and that's just the nature of optics for a really fast f-ratio short focal length telescope. Long focal length ones, the stars are rounder farther away from the center. So depending on how well the optics are made or just short f-ratio is probably going to have that coma anyway. So, yeah, you probably need a coma corrector.
Yeah.
Unless they built something into the system.
Well, as I say, I'm just looking forward to this. Mm-hmm. One of the things that has always fascinated me, and I need to go back to the L-pod from yesterday. Now, I've always been fascinated by the moon. So this is yesterday's. This is June the 14th. L pod. It is a repost for March the 9th, 2019. Sorry, 2009 rather. 2019. Oh my gosh, I'm already ahead of myself. I'm time traveling already, Marty. Now it's from what Chuck Wood is saying. He's had a lot of trouble finding an acceptable image of the North Lunar Pole for his June Sky and Telescope article for that year. Now, there's great numbers of images of the mountain at South Pole because everybody was looking at it because of the ice and everything else. So I thought that, as well as looking at lunar domes, at craters, at the Rills and at the Lunar Mountains. Maybe I'm actually going to make an effort to go and image towards the Lunar North Pole, because it really the only picture we've got that's being used is from the Lunar Atlas, constellated Lunar Atlas image A11 from the Lunar and Planetary Institute. Now, as I say, I've always enjoyed looking at the moon. It never gets boring, because it always changes depending on its phase and how the terminator is moving and what the sun angle is. So, as I say, this is going back to 2009. This is pre-LRO. And, of course, the public outreach officer there started a discussion group with the help of several amateurs, was collecting polar images, basically so they could analyze the opportunities for amateurs to document the impact of LRO. And they thought it was going to be visible mostly from the western US and Hawaii. Obviously, the article says, sorry, Europe, Asia, and eastern USA. Why worry? It's called the internet, which means you can log into the feed and you can be watching for the physical, watching it even on East Coast USA, or even anywhere in Europe, the UK, or Asia. Mm. So the nice thing about modern technology means even though we cannot physically look up to the moon with our telescopes and watch to see this, we can still log in. We could have still logged into the internet. Now, the picture was taken. Oh yes, gotta love the interwebs, haven't you, Starstorm? Now, this was taken on the 61-inch Catalina telescope in Tucson, Arizona. So, and it's Ruckel Plate 4. Now, this is something I think is a very underused resource. There is a whole series of maps of the moon done by Anton Ruckel with zero libration, and he's taken a picture as the moon will be seen from the Earth, applied zero libration so that you can actually find yourself away around the moon. So if I just pull up the plate for this one, this is for Ruckel 4. I'm just waiting for it to load.
So these are astronomical images taken from the Earth, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
As it points out, I'm putting the link into as, chat now.
Say, as opposed to the LRO Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, which took images, yes, from lunar orbits.
So, this map was based on an Earth-based photograph. It's been computer-corrected to zero libration. The vertical white lines indicate the left and right boundaries of the root of the rectangle, and that was done with LTVT. It's a nice piece of software that the Lunar and Planetary Group at the University of Arizona makes freely available.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so, as you can see, the relevant craters. They're all named. And you can see Plato down to one side. And I'm just looking at this very, very quickly. It's got Birmingham. You can see, well, it's very difficult for me to see in this light. But everything is named. And it gives you a very good idea of how to get around the actual moon itself. I find the Ruckel zones to be very, very useful. And it actually has a grid of neighboring maps for the Ruckel near side map. So yeah, making most of this as you can. I understand that the moon wiki spaces is being migrated to a new server soon, so it will not be lost, because there's an awful lot of good stuff there. There's stuff about lunar maps, missions, places, children's books. There's a photo gallery. What more could you want? And, of course, it has a list for the Lunar 100 and special features lists, which I really like, because if I'm using – yeah, I know it's out of print. I've got a copy of the original one, and thankfully I didn't pay stupid money. I got it at a decent price. So, anyway, here is the special features list. It even covers – boulder tracks. LRO cameras captured millions of those. crater chains, chevron-shaped chains of small depressions, clusters of high albedo boulders on wrinkle ridges.
Nice. I really need to get to look at the LRO images. I haven't done that, and I really, really need to.
As I say, you can even find out what atlases are available.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's one of those really, really fun things. It's even got Highland Ponds on it. Nothing to do with Amy Pond, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
sorry, I had to. I'm getting a dirty look for that Doctor Who reference. There, and I just got hit. And of course, all the links are in the chat room.
You might see us if you look across the pond.
Yeah, I might see you. Mm-hmm. I'd probably have to use a satellite, one of those super secret spy satellites, to zoom in.
There you go.
And everything. But, yeah, like I say, there's all kinds of lists here. You're never going to get bored. And if I do get fed up with looking at the moon, I'm going to go look for comets.
There you go.
But having said that...
Wait. Back to the moon. A little visual on the moon. Nice thin crescent tonight. The moon is west, a little closer to the horizon than Venus for the next couple of nights. So this is the time to look for the moon and Venus is a nice thin crescent, and show your friends too. That's when the moon and Venus look about their best, I think, with their crescent moon nearby. And a couple of occultations coming up with the moon. Let's see, next one is June the 16th at what is that Greek letter? Delta. Yes, there it is. That's like tonight, almost now. Delta Cancer. Be visible from northern South America. And then on the 24th, Gamma Libra will be covered by the moon from the Middle East, Northeast Africa, and Southwest Asia. So a couple of occultations of the moon and some – these are about fourth magnitude stars, so not too bad. Nice to have a bright one.
But, yeah, now Starstorm is concerned
of –
Starstorm has plenty of good old-fashioned Cadbury's drinking chocolate. I got her some more over the week. So I will quite happily make her a mug of hot drinking chocolate after the show.
All right. Always fun to watch the moon cover a star.
Yeah. Now, let's go back. Let's do some time traveling, shall we?
All right. I'll see you last week.
I'll see you the week before.
There you go.
Actually, I'm going to go back even further in time.
Farther in time?
Further in time, yes. We are... no anomalies, no dinosaurs coming through. Actually, what we're going to do, we are going to go back to the 70s, 60s and 70s.
All right, I was there, but I don't remember it. Go ahead.
Okay, so the link is in chat. This is how something that was considered to be old hat and no longer needed became so applicable to space travel. Of course, I'm talking about a sextant,
mm-hmm.
and the Apollo sextant, which was used in Earth and lunar orbit, as well as when en route between the Earth and the Moon. It had different roles on each of these contexts. In orbit around the Earth or the Moon, a sextant could be used to compute the spacecraft's altitude and position, whereas in transit, it could be used to compute the spacecraft's attitude, orientation, position, and velocity. So what they actually did, they were actually shooting star. They were doing star shots and moon shots and Earth shots with this device.
I've done schnapps shots.
Yeah, schnapps don't come into it. Unfortunately, they weren't drunk. They weren't allowed to carry any schnapps. They couldn't snap it up like that.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry. Anyway, so there is a very nice picture of the. Sextant from the Apollo version of the sextant. I'm just going to put that into chat as well. Okay, so that is what the Apollo version of the sextant looked like.
I have a sextant around here somewhere.
Yeah. But as I say, the interesting thing was it is an application of the old school of navigation. And what they really did was they were literally using something that from the age of discovery in the modern age. This device, this modern sextant, could literally feed everything into the command module computers and tell them exactly where they are. And apparently, I am told, they were actually in a position where should the actual whole system crash, and they could not talk to the ground domain mission, because you've got to remember, during this time, this was at the height of the Cold War. And they were afraid, the mission control was afraid that the Russians might block transmissions between main mission and the ongoing mission. So they were completely and utterly able, without having to refer to Earth, for that to do navigation on their own and not be lost. So, and from what I understand, the Royal Navy has always taught it. The US Navy has now reintroduced how to use a sextant and tables to work nice. Out where you are for paper navigation. And the US Coast Guard teaches amateur sailors how to use them, and they've been doing that for about the last 10, 15 years. Apparently, in order to get a certificate of contempt, a certificate to say you are competent to sail a boat out of sight of shore, you have to be able to use a sextant. I know everybody says, gee whiz, what about GPS? Well, guess what? If you suddenly become in a time of national emergency, you don't want Tom, Dick, and Harry using GPS against
mm-hmm.
you.
Mm-hmm.
So what they did was they decided, well, okay, amateur sailors need to be able to shoot the sun. They need to be able to do a star shot, and they need to be able to work out where they are using a series of tables and a compass. So part of the competency exam that the US Coast Guard does is how to use a sextant. Now, the nice. Royal Yachting Association in the UK does exactly the same thing.
Good to hear they're getting back into that. I used to teach a lot of like navigation classes with the stars and stuff like that. And a few years ago, the tall ships that they kind of make the rounds, and they came into to Michigan into one of the ports on the Great Lakes. And I asked some of the sailors there about navigation, if they learned use a sextant and stuff like this. They said no, we just use GPS. Like, oh. Great. So you don't really know sailing then.
Yeah. Well, believe it or not, on the early versions of the 747s, they actually came equipped with a sextant port for making optical sightings.
Mm.
Now, the really good point about having a sextant, it doesn't require power, and it is completely independent of any navigational system. It can be employed as a fail-safe if electrically powered equipment and or communications fail. Now, the Apollo sextant played just this role. So working with the AGC and often functioning as a navigational aid, ground-based personnel compared their computed results to those obtained by the sextant as a further backup.
Mm-hmm.
So this device had two separate optical devices that worked together as a functioning sextant. A 1XY telescope, which was used to identify a target constellation or a single star, and a 28X telescope, which was used to make the actual angular measurement. Now, based on this measurement, which is actually very, very precise, the AGC could then compute the position of the command module based on previously stored data. So over the course of an entire mission, constellations, stars, the Earth and the Moon were all targets of the sextant. Yeah. Oh, Black Project is saying actually even 747-400s have a sextant port. Mm-hmm. It is a very important thing to have, because if anything ever went wrong with the onboard navigation or with ground-based navigation, you are quite capable of getting from A to B and back to A on your own without getting lost.
Well, sextants do have some limitations. Sextants mostly measure the altitude of the sun above the horizon. Okay, so that would definitely, well, and if you have like the North Star or the horizon, stuff like that, that will give you your latitude. In order to do longitude, though, you're going to need some charts ahead of time to let you know when when things are going to be at a certain altitude, and that kind of give you a little bit of help with your longitude, and especially if you know the time and stuff like that too. So you check in modern times, sextants need to be used with some computer printouts. So
yeah. Now, Redshirt3's pointed out that the Pan Am Clipper seaplanes also had a clear bubble in the cockpit roof, which were used to take star sightings for navigations. This is back in 1939.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, most bomber pilots had a navigator who was trained not just to work out where they were from airspeed, from wind speed.
Mm-hmm.
They were also able to take, particularly if you were bombing by night, you would be able to shoot the stars, and you would know, based on where you are, an exact position.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Qantas still actually, from reading this note from Black Projects, Qantas, the airline, they actually use a sextant port to clean. They actually use it to clean clean the aircraft's windscreen. So they obviously open the sextant port and put out the stuff they need to clean the windscreen through. So it does have other uses as well. But it's interesting to see practical applications, yeah. But it's still interesting to see that Boeing, certainly with the 747 models, still build this very unique capability into the aircraft.
Just a little quick thing on what sextants do. Basically, you're able to sight two different objects in the sextant and overlap them, and then you read the scale on the side, and it tells you the angular separation. It has some filters in it, so when you're looking at the sun, it filters out the sunlight, makes it safe to look. So you get kind of a half image of the sun and a half image of the horizon overlapping each other, and then once you get them like perfectly overlapped, then you could read the scale on the side of the sextant. So that's basically how they work.
And then you use a series of tables.
Yes.
Do your mathematics.
Mm-hmm.
Old-fashioned navigation is definitely fun and interesting. And mm-hmm. to think that even at the height of the space race, an old-fashioned skill could be applied. Thank you, Starstorm. And was paramount in order to make sure they actually did succeed. And you have to take your hat off to those guys. Most people, even by that point, were using artificial aids. They were using radio signals.
Mm-hmm.
Just the fact that they had the knowledge and the training to do something as old-fashioned as a star sight really does show you how important, even in taking such a short trip, like between the Earth and the Moon, being able to navigate in the old skills mm-hmm. was. And Neil Armstrong proved very importantly just how important it was to be a hands-on pilot, given the fact that the autopilot on the LEM crashed multiple times, meant that he was actually, at the end of the day, it was a manual landing. Because
mm-hmm.
they were supposed to let the spacecraft land itself. And as they came in to the actual main target area, they realized that it wasn't exactly going to be, it was not a good place to land. So they had to look around the Sea of Tranquility for a place to set down.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that meant you're literally hands on. And every now and again, the alarm was going off that the radar system had crashed. And it's back to good old fashioned piloting. In fact, according to what I was reading in the article, the command module pilot for Apollo 11 was using the sextant to look for the command module after it had landed. The problem was, of course, it hadn't landed where it was supposed to land.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you think about it, Richard Gordon was able to use the 28 power telescope portion of the sextant in Yankee Clipper to see the command module Intrepid and the nearby Surveyor probe. Now, NASA have put a short video that's embedded in the article from an episode of the 1998 miniseries about the Apollo program from the Earth to the Moon, and it features a scene of Lovell operating the sextant during Apollo 8. Mm. Now, The other thing is, of course, go on, Marty.
So something else I recommend for amateur astronomers, if you kind of want to get into navigation stuff like that, is an – I don't think it's called an altimeter. It's called something – an altitude gauge, basically. Basically, like a protractor with a string and a weight on it so that you can point it at an object, you know, sight down on the top of it and measure the altitude of an object in degrees. Okay, so modern telescopes, it's got that all computerized. But if you want to get outside, you want to do a little planning of observing session, maybe you want to look for a comet, you can look up a few things ahead of time, like the altitude and the compass direction of a comet that you want to try looking at with your binoculars. Well, how do you figure out how high up above the horizon the comet is? Well, an altitude gauge, basically, is a really great way of figuring that out. I used to have one, and I can't find it anymore. I need to make another one. But, yeah, when you're doing a binocular observing, it really helps.
And, of course, the really good thing about a sextant was that it didn't matter how much the platform shifted or was unstable.
Mm-hmm.
You get a very accurate sighting, and you knew where you were. I'm just trying to see something because there was a note on it. I see the bit about Lovell.
Good night, Richard.
Night, Redshirt 3. Have a great evening. If you want something you can do that will really show off how good an astronomer you are at Star Party, is use that, just do what Marty just did, said, or shoot the stars with a sextant.
Mm-hmm. What's also good for the altitude gauge is finding Venus in the daytime.
Very true.
With binoculars, you know, so that works really, really impresses people. If you can set up a pair of binoculars and point at Venus, basically all you need to know is its azimuth, basically the directions 360 degrees around the horizon, and its altitude. And you build a little device that will set that up, set it on that, aim your binoculars along that line, and you should have no problem seeing it.
So there you go. If you really want to impress people at a star party, mm-hmm. either during the day or the evenings, that's the way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
It can be fun. I think I'm probably going to have to, I will probably at some point take a course in sextants and in navigation the old way, mm-hmm. just for the fun of it, because just being able to do it,
yes.
and pull out the maps, pull out the tables, and show somebody just how to do it the brainy way,
mm-hmm.
if you like.
The primitive way. We have to actually, in brainy, you have to actually think about it.
Exactly. When using a sextant, you need to think about what you're doing. You need to do the math.
Mm-hmm.
And you need paper charts.
Yes.
As much as I love my planetarium programs, yeah, they're great for pointing your telescope and finding something you want to image or look at.
But it doesn't help navigationally.
But, Starstorm says it doesn't help navigationally. And to be honest, it can be fun.
Mm-hmm.
You're doing something which has come down to us over the centuries, and even today in the time of high-tech, ultra-precise GPS.
Isn't always that accurate?
Yeah, I've heard a few stories about people in GPS ending up in rivers.
Yep, putting a compass and an altitude gauge on a Dobsonian works pretty well.
Yeah.
It really helps, too.
Yeah, and Starstorm just got her gravity test device out, and she's playing with it and testing the fact that we still have a gravity of 1G here at the Earth surface.
Mm-hmm.
Right, okay, so away team, are we ready?
We're just about ready to head on out of here, just a little bit more, and it'd be about time to sound the call. So I think we're ready for the call, Nick.
Captain Savick. 3 to beam up. We're ready to come home.
Where's our chirp? We got a chirp? We got a chirp? We don't have a chirp. All right, everybody.
It.
Appreciate you all listening in tonight. Don't forget, we got more programming coming up after the Event Horizon, and we'll repeat those programs every 4 hours for the next 24 hours. I think we're out of here. Good night, everybody. Thanks.
Good night, everyone. Clear skies.
We hope that you've enjoyed this program from AFM Radio, the broadcast service of Astronomy.fm. This program has been released under Creative Commons license. Please contact us for details. You may find more of our AFM original programs on our website. It's really easy to find us. We are astronomy.fm. You may also find us in the iTunes radio listings near the top of the News Talk section, and also as an iTunes podcast selection. We'd love to hear your comments. Please email us at radio@astronomy.fm. Thanks so much for being part of the voice of astronomy around the world and across the known universe. This is astronomy.fm radio.
Hi, this is Tavi Greiner, Astronomy.fm's Vice President of Communications. If you enjoy our programming, please let us know with a donation to astronomy.fm/donate. We really do rely on your support, and it's true, every little bit counts.
AFM.
There I was, doing my thing, and all of a sudden, wham, astronomy right between the eyes.